Well, thank you very much again, Jeff, and it's good again to be with you here this evening. Each of the evenings we've tried to take one of those issues of life that we all have to face, and as Jeff has said, this evening we come to one of the most, I suppose, difficult, sensitive issues that we can all face and will all face at some point in our lives, the subject of grief. Grief, of course, is an experience that comes to everyone's door at some point. But why does grief come? And how can we explain the experience of grief? And can anything be done to help us in our grieving? And does grief have anything to say about me and about my life? And those are some of the questions we want to think about this evening. Now, some in trying to describe what grief is have found it helpful to look at life a bit like a journey. And so we see, if you like, life heading in a certain direction. And we have certain goals, we have a certain destination. And so life goes along in this pathway, and this pathway becomes to us comfortable and familiar. And that gives us a sense of purpose when you think about it, something to live for, something to get up for each day. And it gives us a sense of hope in that we're heading for certain goals and a certain destination. And perhaps if you think about your life in that way, you can identify then with that picture to some degree. In terms of maybe your working life or your family life. Perhaps we don't always take time to stop and think about it, but most of us have a certain pathway and a certain goal to living. But every so often we come up against something in life that blocks the pathway. Events and situations come in that require some kind of change in direction. And so those goals and those aims that we were heading towards are no longer attainable, and life changes direction, and we have to change our destination, and we have to plot a new course. Life changes direction. And we call our response to that change in direction, our response to that we call grief. A technical term that the psychiatrists sometimes use is that it's a reaction to an adjustment, to that change, if you like, in direction. And those kinds of changes in life can be painful. They give rise to all kinds of emotional reactions, and that's what we call grief. And why do we find that kind of change difficult? Why does it cause those sorts of emotional difficulties? Well, I suppose there are a number of reasons for that. One is that the pathway that you're going along in life just becomes comfortable. It becomes familiar. We get into a routine, don't we, of family life and work life. And then when we have to move away from that, we move out of our comfort zone, if you like. For example, a bereavement within a marriage where a couple were used to just doing everything together. And then the remaining spouse has to face so many situations now alone. The current pathway becomes familiar and comfortable to us. Another reason why we find that change in direction difficult is because it means giving up on goals that we had cherished and longed for. Most of us have hopes in relation to family life and working life, and other relationships, things that we want to see happen, things that we want to see achieved. A happy marriage, a comfortable income, that retirement, hopes for a family. And change then threatens those goals, those hopes that we have. For example, again, the death within a marriage that means that the retirement years will be spent alone. So remember, we're asking, why do we find this kind of change difficult? And The second reason there is that we find that we have to give up on goals that we had cherished. I suppose the third reason that we find that kind of change difficult is just really that we're creatures of habit. We get into certain routines, don't we? We get into certain patterns of activity, and those patterns are hard to change. Again, the bereavement within a couple, it means, again, the remaining spouse, they have to pick up new skills and start doing new things they had never done before. The husband, who was used to his wife doing so many of the activities at home, and he now has to begin to do those things. Well, we're creatures of habit, and we find that kind of change then difficult. So we find these changes difficult because, in a sense, they involve loss of what's comfortable and familiar, loss of those goals, and loss of those patterns and routines that we are used to. But what are some of those causes then of this grief, of this kind of change that we have to face? And essentially, those things involve loss. We respond in grief to things that we lose. And of course, we're thinking specifically this evening of the loss of someone in our lives, the loss of someone through death, someone that's been close to us. But when you think about it, we can get that same kind of reaction through other losses, other things that require that change in direction. Losses, for example, in other relationships or in other ways, separation. A divorce in a marriage can create that kind of switch in direction, the change in the goals and so on. A conflict, a falling out with someone. Infertility, and again the hopes of having a family that haven't been realized, a miscarriage, even those who have gone through abortion will go through that kind of change and grief often. The loss can be in relation then to health as well, a life-threatening or terminal illness involving that change, disability, some kind of injury involving amputation and the resulting disability that comes from that, the disfigurement that can sometimes come through an injury. Again, those changes in our health involve that change in direction. Change in our home, our living arrangements. Moving house actually can cause that kind of grief reaction. Emigration to another country, leaving your home for a young person. Even something like a burglary, that sense of threat that comes in and things again change, can cause the emotional reaction that we call grief. And then loss in relation to job or working arrangements, redundancy, retirement as well as unemployment. Remember what we're saying here, that all of these things involve a change in direction of life, the giving up of goals and hopes, the leaving of what is comfortable and familiar, and breaking those patterns of living that we've become used to. They all cause grief. And in a sense, handling those kinds of changes and losses in life, the kind of things we're going to look at this evening in terms of grief, can all be applied to these kinds of changes as well. So then what is this grief that we're talking about? What do we mean by grief? I suppose there are a number of words that come to mind when we think of grieving. One is bereavement, and I suppose bereavement is just really the loss itself, the loss of something or someone that really matters to us personally and emotionally, the loss of a husband or a wife. But it can also be something like a pet, the loss of our health, as I've said, the loss of the role that we fulfill in life. That's the bereavement, then, is the loss. I suppose, then, the grief is really our emotional response to that, and how we respond and our experience, those feelings that we get as a response to the loss. And we'll look at those in a moment. And then maybe a term that we maybe don't think so much of these days, the term mourning. And that's really the way, I suppose, that we express our grief outwardly. And of course, that period of mourning traditionally would have been a period where people would have worn black and so on. It was the outward expression, if you like, of their grieving as a response to the loss. So what does this process of grieving look like? What is the experience of grief? How does grief feel? And that's what we want to take a moment to look at now. Now, people often look at grieving in terms of various stages or phases, and there are lots of different ways of dividing this up, and people have thought of all kinds of a whole lot of different stages of grieving. We're going to keep it fairly simple. I think one of the simplest ways of dividing it up is just into really three stages of grieving. What I would just say before we look at these is that I suppose what they give us is a certain pattern of grieving, which is true of most people, but is not true of everybody. We are individuals, and grieving can affect us in an individual way. Second thing I would say here is that although we're talking about the stages, people don't tend to move neatly from one stage to another. It's not that you sort of go through one stage and then one day you wake up and suddenly you're in the next stage. It tends to be very much a kind of an ebbing and flowing through these stages, and we'll see that as we think our way through them. So really these are just a helpful way of trying to think through the process of grieving. But again, you have to bear in mind that our experience isn't always just so cut and dried as these stages would make us think. So the first stage that we often think about is this stage of numbness, or sometimes people call it denial. And what's really happening there is that the mind just can't take in what has happened. Let's think about it in terms of that loss that comes through the death of someone that's close to us. Our first reaction is often shock and disbelief. We may not feel anything at all. We fail to take in what has happened. People will often say in this at this point of their grieving that they were in a daze. It felt like nothing was real. It felt like they were just existing. And some people think that this isn't healthy, that you should really be feeling everything right from the very beginning. It may actually be just part of how God has designed us, to allow us to cope at the beginning of facing a loss and that major change, and to help us get through those first number of days of the grieving process. Days, as of course we all know, when many practical things have to be arranged and funerals have to be sorted out and so on. And perhaps then God has designed us in such a way that we have this initial period where we can't quite take it in, we can't quite feel anything to ease us into the pain of grieving. As I say, some people sometimes call this denial, where there may be a spoken, if you like, acknowledgement of the death, and maybe the expression of some emotion, but it doesn't seem to quite register. And some people may not even acknowledge that the death has happened at all. We sometimes see this kind of denial in maybe a refusal to accept what has happened, and that can be expressed in lots of different ways. Perhaps a refusal to visit the grave, or to allow in memories of the deceased, for example, not looking at photographs and so forth. Now, this first, I suppose, stage of numbness can last for anything from a number of days up to a number of weeks, and for some people even into a few months. Not that it would be there constantly for that time, but certainly there can be some remnants of it for that length of time. But eventually this numbness tends to give way, and it gives way into a stage that is sometimes called yearning. And if that first stage of grieving is that the mind can't quite take in what has happened, then the next phase, this yearning, is that the mind is really searching. The mind is now trying to, if you like, face the reality of what has happened. Face the reality that this dead person has now gone. This can bring on a very intense feeling, a very intense pining after the person, that the old familiar pathways, as we talked about, have now gone and have now been lost. And here are some of the features of this stage of yearning. As I say, the mind is on a search. The mind is trying to take in and make sense of what has happened. And often people will go over a lot of the old stories, the old memories, and recall what kind of person then the deceased was and begin to reminisce. And it's actually one of the functions of the wake, and can be quite a healthy then function of the wake. But it helps then those that are left behind to begin to come to terms with what has happened and the fact that their loved one has died. It can actually be a source of comfort, this reminiscing. Remember, the mind is trying to make sense of what has happened and is embarking on this search. And sometimes in this phase of grieving can almost play tricks on us. Remember, the mind was kind of used to having the person always there, and then the mind itself struggles to make sense of the loss. And commonly then we get these things called hallucinations, where, if you like, the mind plays tricks on us. We can commonly, for example, believe that we've seen the dead person. You're walking down the street and you're sure you saw them at the other side of the road. Or maybe commonly people describe things like, I heard him come in from work again, or I'm sure I heard him upstairs. I could have sworn it was him. I've heard people say that often. Again, it can happen sometimes whenever we're dropping off to sleep or waking up out of sleep. We get these hallucinations. We maybe think we see the person in the dim light of twilight, maybe at the far end of the room. And again, it's all part of this searching, the mind trying to make sense of what's happened. This mind who is so used to having the person there and so used to seeing them that in a sense it nearly still does. And it's trying as well to kind of get used to the person not being there. This yearning phase then, if in the numbness phase the emotions aren't really getting into gear, well, they certainly do as time goes on, and we get a number of emotional responses. Anger can be quite a common one that maybe we feel sometimes reluctant to admit to, because we feel that, well, we shouldn't feel angry about the person who has died. But if we're honest, it can be there. Anger for all kinds of reasons. Anger that we are now left to pick up the pieces. Anger that it shouldn't have happened, that it's not fair. And there's a sense actually in which that anger, I think, is the right response, and that death really was not the way it was meant to be. And we'll touch on that before we finish this evening. But anger is a common emotional reaction in grieving. Guilt as well. I could have done more. I could have done something to prevent this. I should have been there. I'm to blame. Guilt in bereavement often manifests itself with sentences that begin with "if only." If only I'd phoned at that time, or if only we hadn't had that argument, or I wish there'd been a chance to sort such and such a thing out. We can often feel that there's unfinished business. I should have done more. I'll never forgive myself. That's the kind of conversation of guilt that can happen whenever we're yearning. Fear is a common symptom in depression, or in grieving, and of course also with depression. We've mentioned it the past couple of evenings, but fear, anxiety, remember the muscles tensing, the heart pounding, the butterflies, the sweating, you can feel that grief, that anxiety can be there for various reasons, the worries of how we're going to cope without the deceased. Loneliness, of course, coming back to the empty home again, and can be desperately difficult for many people, especially if the loss has been of a significant companion, like a husband or a wife. Hopelessness, again, a common experience in grieving. People feel that now there's no way forward. Remember, there's been that change in direction. Maybe they're still looking back at the old way and they just can't see the way forward. They can't see any new goal, new destination. That hopelessness begins to creep in. And then, of course, the helplessness. How will I survive? How will I cope? How will I manage the things that I've never done before? The other person did everything, and the thought of taking on these new responsibilities just seems like too much to cope with. And you can notice, can't you, that a lot of these things are quite similar to depression that we described in the first evening. And there certainly is an overlap between grieving and depression. Now, if that first phase of numbness lasts anything from days into weeks or even into a month or two, this yearning phase can really last from anywhere up to 6 months to even into a year or two. And even I've seen in some grieving, certainly some aspects of yearning carrying on into the years for some people. But finally, there comes a point when, although people will often say that they never properly feel they get over the loss, people begin in bits and pieces to come to some point of acceptance, where this yearning begins to fade. People begin to accept that the deceased has now gone and the changes that the death has brought. And they do begin to make that change in direction. They do begin to plot the new course and to take on the new challenges. They begin to find new companions on the journey. And life takes on that new direction and becomes reorganized again. If you like, grief comes in and causes, as you can imagine, then a whole lot of disorganization in our living and in how we feel. And eventually life can begin to feel reorganized again. And that begins to bring a sense of relief and a sense of security, actually, because you begin to get a sense of security in this new course of life that is being plotted out. And in a sense, then, if the mind can't take it in here and the mind is on a search here, I suppose in this phase of grieving is the mind beginning to accept, beginning to come to terms with what has happened, beginning to accept the new direction and to go after those new goals. Just to say then that there are just a few points to remember as we're looking at these phases of grief. I did say at the beginning that it is quite an individual thing. There aren't any two people that will grieve in the same way. And it's important to remember that, because we can often think that because someone who is close to us and was also close to the deceased, and because they're not reacting in exactly the same way as I am, then maybe they're not grieving properly. And sometimes people get a bit anxious about others not grieving properly, that there's something wrong with someone else's grief. But really, grief does affect us in very individual ways. And we'll look in a moment at why that might be. I've mentioned already, it's got that nice cut-and-dried movement from one phase to another. There's a bit of ebbing and flowing, but that's the general direction of moving forward through the phases. And the other thing I would say is, and I've alluded to it, is that the time scales are not set in stone. They're kind of a rough guide, but there's a lot of variation between people. And lastly, I would just say, in terms of points to remember, is that actually, and it's probably important to say that these days, that different cultures will grieve differently. And we are living in an increasingly multicultural society, and we've got to remember this and to acknowledge that there are some cultures which still go through a much more ritualized grieving than perhaps we are beginning to in this society. More like what we would have experienced in maybe a number of generations back. And so different cultures grieve differently. Now, I mentioned there that as individuals we can grieve differently. And even in a very close family where there's been a loss of someone within the family circle, that grief can affect us in different ways. Well, why is that? why do we grieve differently? Why for some people does grieving seem to be much more complicated and more prolonged, and yet for others they seem to go through difficulty for a while, but they do seem to get through and get over it. I just want to look for a moment at some of those factors that can make grieving for some people more prolonged, more complicated, more difficult, can leave us to at a point where we seem to be not moving through those stages, and we seem to be getting stuck, and it seems to almost lead into a kind of a depression, grieving that's more difficult and more complicated. And there are a number of factors as to why that might be, and I suppose I've divided them up into factors, first of all, that are outside, external factors. The place of the death, where the death happened, can actually be a factor. I remember once coming across a family who had the death of a family member in a different country, in fact, in a different continent altogether. And for that family, it was a very, very difficult thing. Their loved one had been on holiday, had been travelling. And whenever the death is far away like that, and particularly whenever the body and the grave maybe have not been seen, it can very much hinder the acceptance of the death, and therefore hinder, if you like, the grieving. Another of those factors that can make grief more complicated is if there have been a number of deaths together. Both coincidental deaths, in other words, deaths that occur at the same time in a community or a family, simultaneous death, multiple deaths, that can make our grieving more complicated. Or even successive deaths that seem to happen in close kind of succession, where, if you like, we've begun to grieve for the first death, and then we're through that, getting through that process, and then there's another loss, and it's almost like the grieving for the first gets interrupted by the second, and so forth, and that can make grieving more complicated and much more difficult. Another factor that affects your grieving is the kind of death that has been the cause. And what I mean there is deaths that have been sudden, that have been untimely, violent or traumatic, will often cause a more difficult grieving. And then this is the kind of social network that we are living in at the time, where families and a community are more closely knit, then that can help the grieving process. And indeed, the attitude of the community, the attitude of society, even to the grieving and to the death, can also help or hinder. See that, for example, in the death, where the death has been a suicide, and wherefore the family that are left behind, often there is a huge amount of stigma associated with that, and that can affect the grieving very significantly. So the social network and the response, if you like, of the community and so on around is very, very important. So there are a number of factors that can affect how we grieve. And then, of course, there are a number of, if you like, inside factors, or things that are going on inside of us, our own attitudes to the grieving that can affect that. And this is important because this is one of the reasons why within a family, for example, certain members may grieve differently. And one of the big ideas to get here is this idea of the significance of the person to you, how much you love them, how big a part they played in your life. And you can understand then that the bigger a part the person played in your life, then the bigger the loss will be to you, the more significant the loss will be. And you can find then that sometimes you can have someone who was maybe a very close relative, a family member, and yet, although they were related closely to you, they may not have played such a big role in your life have been so significant to you. And so even though they were close to you, your grieving of them may not be so painful. Whereas someone who maybe is a more distant relative or someone who's not related to you, and you lose them, that can be much more painful and much more difficult. And the reason for that is that the person is more significant to you. They play a bigger part in your life, and so therefore it makes sense, doesn't it, that the loss of that person is going to be much more difficult for you. Another one of these, if you like, internal factors that can affect our grieving is the quality of the relationship. And if you like here, the more straightforward the relationship, then the less complicated the grief will be. But if your relationship to that person was emotionally complicated, if it was a kind of a love-hate relationship, or if it was associated, for example, with a lot of guilt, then your grieving for that person is going to be a lot more complex and difficult. And so the quality of the relationship is very important and does affect our grieving quite significantly. And then another factor here that can affect how we grieve are those unanswered questions. And if we have those unanswered questions, then our grieving is more complicated. Those questions like, well, could I have done more? And even the question of the person's salvation. And I'm going to come back to some of those unanswered questions just in a moment or two. So we've thought a bit about what grief is. We've looked at some of these stages and tried to understand how grieving affects us, why it feels the way it feels. And we've seen that there are certain factors then that can make our grieving more complicated and more difficult, and help to explain that. Let's look now at how we deal with grief. How do we help someone who's grieving? I suppose we'll look at it from that point of view, but of course hopefully we'll find things that will help ourselves as we face our own grieving. And it's maybe most helpful just to think through the stages that we did at the beginning and to look at each of those stages, what are going to be the things that are going to be most helpful. I remember then in this early stage of the grieving, the mind can't quite take in what has happened. There's that numbness, the feelings that haven't really got into gear yet. And so this really isn't a time for deep discussion. It's not a time to get into all of the big questions. It's not a time to try and work everything out, because really, remember, the mind just can't take it in. Everything's numb, and the person's trying to make sense of it. It's really a time, I think, for sympathy, a time for comfort, a time for trying to feel what the other person might be feeling, a time for weeping with those who weep, as we read in the scriptures. And so it's a time for really just being with someone, a time for sympathy and trying to help them through. It's also a time for listening rather than speaking. Allow the stories to be told. The more the stories of the circumstances, even of the death itself, are told, then the more you're helping the person to come to terms with what has happened. And we all know what it's like, don't we? It can be hard to know exactly what to say to someone who has lost a loved one. And so just listen. Learn to tolerate the silence. Don't feel the pressure to have to say something. If you're like me, then it's whenever we're feeling that pressure that sometimes we come out with completely the wrong thing. And just being there can be very, very important for the bereaved. There's so many people that I've heard this often. You know, people will say that, you know, one of the things that meant the most to them in their grieving was just to have people there. And often, if you're one of those people who are just there, you know, you feel that you're not really doing anything, you don't know what to say, and you're not being much of a help, but actually your presence and your support is hugely important. It's a time for being practical. There are things to be done, there are arrangements to be made, there are visitors to the home, there's hospitality. There's lots of tea to be made for people. If you've been through that situation yourself, think of what you find helpful then, and that will help to direct you as to what you might be able to do to help in the situation. Be a friend. Don't disappear. Don't get offside. Be there. Be faithful. And yet, on the other hand, it's a time that it's important not to interfere, especially whenever you're a step away from those who are nearest to the deceased. It's important to give them their place. Let the family make their decisions. It's also a time to be careful of getting into conflict, because conflict at times of grief can be remembered for a very long time. It's a time when everybody's very raw and emotions are raw, people are feeling the pain, and so it's important, I think, to try and avoid conflict at all costs. And be careful, it really should go without saying, but I suppose the scriptures remind us of it, and that we should remind ourselves to be careful of singing songs with a heavy heart, as Proverbs would say. Don't try to cheer people up whenever they're in the midst of their grieving. They're feeling the loss and the pain, and we're called to feel that with them. So, some ideas then of how to help in that period of numbness. What about then this period of yearning, when the mind is then on this search and the feelings are beginning to come, the anger, the guilt, the sadness, the fear, and the questions are coming, and the mind is playing tricks on you? What do we do in that stage? Well, keep on listening, because it is then that the person is beginning to talk more and to express some of those questions and difficulties that they might be having. So keep on listening. How is the grief affecting this person? What are those features, if you like, of the grieving that they are getting? It's also a time, I think, for reassuring. Reassurance in the sense that it's good for someone who's grieving to know that, you know, it's okay to feel this way. It's quite normal to feel this way. Remember what we said, there's that whole change in direction. There's all of the emotional upheaval of that. And it is going to feel the way it feels. And that's normal. It's okay to feel pain. There is a real loss here. As we were thinking earlier, you know, Jesus was affected in these kinds of situations himself. It's fine to feel that emotion. And it can even help someone maybe to, because people can feel guilty about the way they're feeling even. And it's helpful maybe to explain to them that there is that change in life and that change of routine, and to help them to see that the mind is searching and trying to make sense of the loss, and that it can play tricks on you in that kind of situation, and that the person then just isn't going mad, which sometimes they can feel. And then there's a place for trying to, in this phase, face those issues honestly, the questions that people are trying to deal with. To do it wisely, to do it gently, to be careful about how you do it. It's not a time for lecturing. It's a time for speaking the truth in love, speaking the truth in the right way, giving words that are seasonable, that are spoken at the right time, going gently, going sensitively, and yet, I suppose, not being afraid to talk openly about the loved one that has gone. And as I say, it's a time whenever those questions will arise, and I think it's helpful maybe to look at them. So we're going to look at them now. Just before we do, I'm conscious, and it may even be that there are some here that are themselves going through a period of grieving or have been recently, and some of these things may strike a chord with you. I just want to say that, you know, this is an attempt to look at some of these issues. In any individual situation, there will be an individual way of looking at that. And so really what I want to do is just to get you thinking about some of these questions. There are answers in the scriptures to them. But bear in mind that they will have maybe some specific application in your life. And again, if it raises anything that causes any difficulty for anyone, please feel free to to have a chat about that at the end. The last thing we want to do is to make things more difficult for you. But what do we do then with those questions that people face? Well, people can often say it shouldn't have happened. And that's very common whenever the bereaved feels angry. And it's important that we deal with that because that anger can get stuck. They feel guilty about feeling angry, but they feel angry and they don't quite know what to do with it. And they can often feel angry if there was unfinished business with the deceased. Maybe some failure in care of the person who has died, or some unfinished business of a personal nature. And we've got to face those matters honestly and not just try to gloss over them or to bury them. There may have been unfinished business. There may have been real failures in care of the person who has died. And these things have got to be faced. They have got to be brought before a God who is wise and who is just and who is Lord over all. And a God who also appoints the times and the limits to our lives. In Psalm 139, we read these words. The psalmist says, "Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be." Our days have been ordained for us before they actually come into existence. Again, in Acts 17, Paul, in the middle of one of his sermons, he states this, that from one man God made every nation of men, and that he determined the times that were set for them. Acts 17 and verse 26. Again, that idea that God determines the times that have been set for us. And it's important for us to come before those kinds of truths as we face issues like that and questions like that. It shouldn't have happened. This wasn't the right time. What about that issue of I could have done more? If only, those if only questions that we have. And there that touches, doesn't it, on the whole issue of guilt. Again, we've got to face that truthfully. Perhaps we didn't do all that we could. Which of us will ever feel that we've done anything perfectly? We're all poor in spirit. And there can be countless reasons for why we weren't able to do all that we would have liked to do. Or there may be no good reason whatsoever for the guilt. Remember what we've said the last few evenings, that often that feeling of guilt is something that we go then looking for a reason for. But again, it's important that we face the guilt rather than gloss over it. Where the guilt is real, where there have been real failures, again, it drives us to the cross, where all of our failures and all of our omissions, all of our weakness has been dealt with and paid for, recovered. We go back to the cross and what Christ has done, where those failures are real. But often, as I say, guilt is a feeling that we get in grieving, and we go looking for a reason. It's not, therefore, a true guilt. And often that feeling of guilt is there because we're judging ourselves by our own standard, not God's standard, because of believers where we have fallen short of God's standard that has been paid for fully and completely at the cross. Then we begin to judge ourselves by some standard that we set up, something that we believe we should have done. And it's our standard, our false standard, rather than God's. So we might believe that we should have called the doctor sooner. We believe we should have done more. And those around us will all try to reassure us and say, but you have other things on at the time, so many other responsibilities that you are balancing. And yet what we have done is that we've set up a standard that we believe we've fallen short of. And the problem is not what we've neglected to do. The problem is that we've set up this standard that we're judging ourselves by. And the problem is our expectation of ourselves. It's a standard that God doesn't hold us to. And behind that, there can be all kinds of things that we are expecting of ourselves. Expecting ourselves to be in control, to get everything right all of the time. And in a sense, what we have to help someone there to do is to see that that's what the problem is, and to repent of that and to change their mind about that, so that they don't judge themselves by that standard and have that false kind of guilt. So if only I could have done more. What about this one? I just can't forgive myself. We've often heard people say that. It comes up a lot in grieving. The kind of way it comes up is we hear people say things like, well, I know God forgives me, but I just can't forgive myself. I think about that for a moment. Again, that's a bit like the last one. When you think about it, we're judging ourselves by some kind of rival standard that we set up alongside God's standard. Remember, where we have fallen short of God's standard, that's been paid for by Christ. Christ met that standard for us, and our falling short of it, our sins have been paid for by Christ, and we are forgiven by God of all of the true wrongs that we've done. And yet we come in sometimes with our own idea of what we should have done, and we feel in debt to that standard, and we can't forgive ourselves. And the problem again is that we are making too much of what we feel we should have done. And that's what the real problem is there. Again, instead of accepting that, well, it is the Lord who gave this life, and the Lord who has taken it away. And where he may have used our weakness and our failure, well, Jesus has covered all of that. And so we are truly free and truly forgiven. I just can't forgive myself. What about this one? A period of reminiscing, that yearning, if you like, and reminiscing over the past, often focuses on all of the positive aspects of the person who has died. But for those who are closest to that person, often that can leave them with a tension and with a conflict. Because whilst they're listening to the deceased's reputation being portrayed as near perfect and all the good qualities being focused on, they know that all the weaknesses and all the bad points are being overlooked. And that can create a tension. And that can create a difficulty within the person who's grieving. And so it's important that they have some space to be able to say, well, you know, he wasn't always like that, or she wasn't always like that. There were these difficulties, and I struggle with that now that they're gone. It's important that that's acknowledged honestly. How will I cope when someone significant is taken, someone we would lean on, someone we would go to for advice, that can leave this huge hole and this anxiety about the future? And again, it's good to look at that practically. Where are the concerns? Where do they lie? And let's see if we can help the person practically with those things that they fear. But again, it's often important to remind the person who's been left behind that when the deceased was alive and you felt you needed them so much and you were leaning on them so much, ultimately, it was always the Lord who was your real helper. Yes, maybe he used your husband or your wife or that other person who was close to you, but it was always the Lord who was really helping you, and the real helper hasn't left you, and he remains a very present help in times of trouble. And then finally, this huge question that can sometimes be left, a very difficult question. Where is he now, or where is Shinai? And just this week I had someone that asked me that very question. Sometimes we have confidence. Sometimes the person made a very clear profession. There was fruit, there was evidence, and we can have confidence that they are with the Lord. But sometimes we don't have that confidence, and we have to be honest about that, and that's hard. I do think that in heaven there will be surprises. Jesus himself taught us that not everyone who says, "Lord, Lord," will be there in the kingdom of heaven. Not everyone who is professing to be a Christian, professing to know Jesus as their Lord, will actually be in heaven. There will be surprises. And I do wonder if there won't be surprises in the other direction. Many who knew the thief on the cross and who perhaps did not overhear that exchange between Jesus and the thief at Calvary would have been shocked to have thought that this man would have been in paradise with the Lord. And yet he was. He made that last moment call, and Jesus promised him that he would be in paradise with him. There may be many last moment calls from God. Of course, Jesus Christ is the only way to heaven, and we leave that with him. There are secret things that belong to the Lord and things that we must leave with him. So it's important, I think, to look at these questions honestly and to remember that in this phase of yearning, the mind is searching, the mind is trying to make sense of what's happened, trying to resolve the loss. And if we skim over these issues and these questions without facing them honestly, then we don't give people the chance to be able to resolve them. And it's often, I would say, in counselling those, I mean, most people that go through grieving don't need counselling, because grieving is one of those experiences of life that we will all face. But I would say that for those that actually do have to come and get some help because they're stuck and they're having difficulty, it's often around these kinds of issues that they're having that kind of difficulty with their grieving. So remember, what we're asking, how can we help with grieving? We've seen how we can help in terms of that first stage when things are numb, and we've just been looking at how we help in that yearning phase. How do we help then in this final stage of reorganizing? The issues are beginning to get resolved, the yearning is beginning to reduce, and we're getting better days. It's a bit like getting better from depression. There are good days and bad days. The good days get a bit better and more frequent, the bad days less frequent and not so bad. You will get the occasional awful day out of the blue. That's quite normal. I remember a friend of mine who had gone through a very difficult time of grieving, and he and his wife thought things were going well. He described me how he was then driving down the motorway, and feeling fine, driving down the motorway, and suddenly this wave of emotion came over me. Had to pull across to the side and wasn't able to contain things. Again, just out of the blue, that sense of grief. And that will happen even when things seem to be getting better. But in this phase of reorganizing, then, will we encourage that reorganization? Remind the person that there is a change of direction, there are new goals to be set, there are new challenges to face. God has still prepared good works for you to walk in. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10. As Paul reminds the Philippians, God is still completing his good work that he's begun in your life. So there is purpose, even though it all feels very disorientating. There is purpose. And so it's good to help the person to point in that new direction, to set new goals and to establish new routines. And there are some ways that we can help them to do that. It involves often looking for new opportunities. How will the bereaved person now spend their time? How will the routine look different? What possibilities are open for establishing a new routine. Look for new opportunities. What about new interests, new outlets? What is the person good at? What are those things that I always thought about doing but never got around to getting to? What maybe hobbies could they take on? Could they do some new learning, do a course? Are there places where they could go to find new friendships and develop a new companionship and battle the loneliness? So new interests and new relationships. Again, all of it towards setting new goals and plotting a new course. I'll just quickly mention one special circumstance, grieving in children, because people often ask about this, and it's something that we can maybe ignore. We think maybe the children are not really affected by losses in the same way that we are. And that's true, but they are affected. Up until the age of 5, a child will often expect the dead person to return. It's good to remember that, because often, you know, a child who's, you know, at the stage where they can talk and say things, they might say something which can be very difficult for everybody else. You know, when so-and-so coming back, or, you know, they've been away, when are they coming back again? And that is difficult for everyone around them. But it's because that child in those early years of life doesn't yet have a concept of death, doesn't yet really understand that. And that's why they just assume the person has gone away and is coming back. And it's good to remember that. Between about the ages of 8 and 10, a child will develop then the adult's concept of death, or begin to. Although up until about the age of 10, often a child can feel that they themselves are responsible, or have had some kind of part to play in the death of the person. The reason for that is that really, again, up until about the age of 10, the child's life really revolves around them. And that's true whenever you think about it, isn't it? That a child really doesn't see much further than their own needs. It's just the stage of development that they're at. And that then has the impact that whenever something bad happens to someone, the child will often think, well, that must be down to me. It's important to recognize that, because it's good then to be able to talk that out with the child. That might be one reason why they may be more withdrawn or have some changes in their behavior. So it's good to talk it through with the child, to see what they're thinking, to try and correct their wrong thinking. Allow the children their memory. Sometimes today, children are encouraged to have things like memory boxes where they maybe collect little mementos and so on of the deceased, if it's been someone close to them. And that allows them to get their head around that, and for their mind to accept things and to come through that phase of yearning. Children at a time of loss like that, they also feel that disorientation of the change of direction, so it's good to make them feel secure. Children really need to feel secure at those times, and we shouldn't forget that. Well, people sometimes say, I'll never get over it, and life will never be the same again. And I think we've seen this evening that it's not so much getting over the death or letting go of it. It's more that life takes a different direction, a different course, and it's the effect of that upon us. But are there any answers to this ultimate question, then, of loss? And let me finish this evening by briefly mentioning a group of men who went through a very complicated grieving. They were a group of young men who had to face the murder of one of their friends. It was an untimely death. The young man who died was only in his early 30s. It was an unjust killing. This young man had been innocent of any wrong. And the other young men, his friends, were left in circumstances of fear. They had too many of them flee for fear that they might be implicated in the young man's death. The deceased had been a major part of their lives for a few years. In fact, they had spent most of that few years together. And his death left the other young men with many unanswered questions, because the deceased had promised many great things, and now it all seemed to be in tatters. These young men were facing a pathway where there were all kinds of great ambitions and great goals ahead of them. Life seemed to be mapped out, and now it was all gone, swiped away, left in tatters. The young man who died was, of course, Jesus, and the death was Jesus' execution at the hands of Pilate and the Jewish leaders. It had all the factors that would lead to a very prolonged and complicated grief for those that were left behind. And his friends certainly felt that pain. They went into denial. Initially, they were yearning, then they were searching. And yet what we read about them in the Bible is that very quickly all of that gave way to lives that were suddenly very reorganized and full of purpose and determination and hope. And what is it that made the difference with those young men? Well, what made the difference was that their friend Jesus didn't remain dead. The Bible tells us that on the third day he came back to life. He met with these young men, and he was seen by many, many witnesses, so that today we have an historical record of his appearances. And of course, that's the basis for our hope as Christians. And after Jesus had risen and was meeting with his friends, he said these words to them. He said, "I am with you always. I will never, ever leave you." Grief, as we've seen, is about loss and the change that that loss brings into our lives. And not just loss through death, but loss, as we saw at the beginning, through many kinds of changes in our lives. They can all cause that kind of grief. And so how can we encourage people to find something that is permanent in a world and in a life that is full of loss, where we will leave things behind, where things are under threat, where things die, where people die? Where can we find a permanent relationship that can never be lost? And of course, we find it in a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. What he promises to us is a relationship that will never end, that will never be lost. Everything else in your life will change and will disappear. But even death cannot take away that relationship with Jesus Christ. "I will never, never leave you," he says. The question is, why? How come? How come death? How come the ultimate loss cannot take away that relationship with Jesus? Well, as we read together in John chapter 11, Jesus himself lost a friend to death. A friend he loved, a friend he had visited, a friend he had stayed with, a friend who was significant to him. And when Jesus faced his friend's death, as we read, he was troubled, he was distressed, he wept. And then he did an amazing thing, and I hope you caught the amazement of that as we read it together. He took his friend's dead, lifeless, decaying body, and he called it to life. And Jesus' friend Lazarus rose. And what was Jesus saying in that act? He was saying, "I am facing your greatest enemy, our greatest enemy, death, the ultimate loss. I am facing that enemy, and I have won." Jesus said, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die." Never die. Do you believe this? Jesus giving eternal life. Life that even our physical death cannot interrupt. Jesus said earlier in the Gospel of John, John chapter 8, he said, "Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death." The Jews then said to him, "Now we know that you have a demon. Abraham died, as did the prophets, yet you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death." Never taste it. Why is grief so hard? Ultimately, grief is so hard because death is our enemy. Death is an enemy. And at the cross, on that first Easter Sunday, death was beaten. And hope, therefore, is real. And heaven is a reality. And like the disciples, we therefore do not grieve like those who have no hope. Because Jesus will never leave us, either in our grief or in our death. If anyone keeps my word, he will never see death, life that is uninterrupted, even by our physical death. And what does that lead to? Well, it leads to words that I'm going to leave with Jesus from Revelation 21. "And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away." That's the life. That's life. And that's the life that Jesus gives us.